Welcome to the ADHD Mums Podcast, a safe place for everyday Australian mums to discuss their struggles with ADHD, motherhood and life.
Welcome to the next episode of ADHD Mums. I am very excited to tell you that Millie Carr is back again. How are you, Millie?
I'm really good. So glad to be back.
It has been a while. I was actually checking Apple Podcast recently. The viewer consumption on your episode is always above 90%, which is pretty cool if you think about we usually go for over an hour and over 90% of the people go the whole way. The other episodes that you've done, I'm going to pop them on your episode notes. One of the ones that we did was about camouflaging and masking, and the other one was about the Australian school system. So, Millie, you are a teacher. Can you give us a little bit of an overview just in case anyone doesn't know who you are?
Yeah, no, I have a lot of different kind of that I wear that kind of comes into this entire topic. So I'm a mum and I have two diagnosed children, autistic and ADHD, recently diagnosed last year myself with ADHD. I'm a teacher currently not working in a classroom, but working in a Victoria, we call it a learning specialist role. I'm a coach and in a leadership kind of position, working with teachers around their practice and also supporting behaviour actually comes a lot into and being comes into my role quite a bit as well. And then on all of this kind of has led me to do my own kind of side business, books that created visibility for children with diagnoses and differences and that kind of stuff. My purpose has always been probably bigger, but it's starting to come to light. That purpose is about education as a whole, thinking about catering to these students. And there's an entire kind of reform and change that's happening at the moment in the neurodiversity space. And I think people are talking about it more, visibility is happening more. And I just feel so passionately about people knowing the things that we know, that sharing this stuff and making people aware of this is so important. And I just want the next generation to really have a different upbringing, a different way of being when they get to their 20s and 30s. Because I know, Jane, you're similar to me, diagnosed so late. I just feel like it's had a massive impact and a toll negatively, but also positively. But I just would like people to know before they get to their 30s. So there's lots of purpose and value-driven stuff behind that. But my credentials and teaching and lived experience really helped me push that forward.
Yeah, absolutely. And you and I say all the time that I have not yet spoken to somebody who's late diagnosed who said they wish they didn't know or they wish that their parents had have not told them. We're here on a diagnosis topic. So I suppose there's a few different parts to it. There is the why would you disclose a diagnosis to a child or why would you get them diagnosed? And then the second part is how would you actually disclose that diagnosis to a child? For anyone who doesn't know, Millie writes really great books called Unmasking Millie. So that's why Millie's here is because I actually read my daughter that book. And I thought, what better person than Millie who wrote the book to come on the podcast? So if we start back in the beginning, and Millie's obviously a teacher, so she's somebody that would be working with diagnosed and undiagnosed children all the time. What would be your perspective on diagnosis for children, Millie?
Yeah, I think about it in a story of my own kind of experience. And then I've got other experiences I've seen too. But growing up, I was in a classroom. I often did not listen to what was being said. I went back to the table and tried to look like I knew what was going on. I went home and did extra things to make sure that I was like on the right page as everybody else. I went through all of my schooling feeling like I was just not really great at school. But I still did well because I put so much effort into it, so much more than everybody else. Like I know I could see my studying level was like ridiculous, but then I would do really well in things that I was able to prepare and have time for. Exams and tests, horrendous. It would bring my mark all the way back down because my brain just can't think in that moment. I went all through my schooling going, oh my goodness, I'm not good. I'm dumb. I'm stupid. I've been very bad at math since I was in primary school. Some teachers still do this and it really upsets me, but getting kids in a circle and doing multiplication times tables and you have to just call it out. The trauma involved in that for me is like massive. I refuse to do that in my own classroom, but people are still doing that kind of thing. And there's all this trauma that's come from feeling that way and feeling inadequate. I knew that I was different. Like I knew that I had to be someone different to fit in. And I did do that. And that's what the whole masking and my book is about, is that I did do that. I watched everybody else and I was like, all right, when I'm loud and I'm cutting in and talking over people, people don't like that. So I'm going to stop doing that. Or when I'm in this social group, I act like this. And then when I'm in this social group, I act like this. And I went through, I never had a really set group of friends in high school. I'd bounce from five different groups because I could get along with everybody because I was able to put on a complete act. My ability to actually mask and change and morph myself for situations is pretty impressive when you think about it. But at the time, it was a survival instinct just to try and fit in and not feel like I was being bullied. I made it look like I was organized at school so that people thought that I was. My grades are really good. I got always feedback from people that how great I was and how I was a school captain. Like, there were all these things that I did that was like amazing, but behind closed doors, I was not doing that. And then I leave school. I fell pregnant at 20 in the middle of doing uni. And that was because, like, again, my impulse control, there's so many things involved in that. I had my daughter at 21. I continue to do my study. There's all these different things that I'm doing. I've done cake decorating. I've done a personal training. I literally have done my Cert 3 and 4. I've done all these things. And I was so hard on myself all the time. Why do I move from this thing and then that thing and then this thing and then that thing? Mediocre-ish at lots of different things, but I can't find my thing. And that the self-esteem and the effects that it had on me personally is massive. And I've spoken to other people like yourself, Jane, and there's other people that are listening to this podcast, mums especially, because the female adult demographic is the most undiagnosed group of people. I've heard it referred to as the lost kind of generation of people being diagnosed. My traits, my presentation were different, but also I was able to mask it really well. Other people can't. And I just think about this diagnosis thing, and I think about the fact that if I knew about this sooner, if I knew there was a reason for it, I'm thinking of my mental health. I'm thinking of all the things that have come from feeling that way at school and not knowing about that my entire life. No one saying, hey, Millie, there's like something here. The reason why you do things is because of this. And the reason it's really hard is because the world isn't set up to allow your brain to be the way it is. It's just not. And because of that, I felt terrible about myself for so long. And I think that I am still in the process of unpacking that. I'm still in the process of trying to help myself with the trauma and make sense of what's going on, make sense of those horrible, I guess, words that I use about myself and about me being just useless. I'm not good enough. I've got to just try harder. I just can't do it. Just got to try a bit harder. Just got to get the right motivation or the right thing to do. And it just always made me feel terrible. And I think that diagnosis and having a diagnosis, no matter what age you end up getting it, there's never a point where it's too old, I think, to get diagnosed. I think if you're 60 and you're thinking about it, I think what it's doing is helping you reframe and re-go over your trauma and your experiences, because you look at it in a different way and in a different lens. And it's quite confronting to do that and go back and go, oh my God, I hated writing. I absolutely hated it in school, but I didn't get time. I didn't get support. The pressure was just so much. There were different reasons why I did things. And I think that has been a massive big problem. And I think when you look at statistics of how many adults, there are 80% of adults just aren't diagnosed. 80% of adults don't know they have ADHD when they do. There is all the adverse effects. There's a quote from, I wrote it down for you, Jane, from Russell Barkley. He's the leading researcher in this field about undiagnosed ADHD knocks off an average of 13 years of your life. That's massive.
Oh,
massive. That statistic, I was going to say, I can find exactly, that's from Russell Barkley. And I think if you really think about it, the adverse effects and consequences that we've got addiction. There are people that are addicted to substances, even mental health issues with eating disorders. You've got car accidents, you've got impulsivity, you've got a lot of people that are incarcerated have ADHD. You've got so many different adverse effects to not knowing because.
Oh, can I jump in with one?
Yeah, yes, please.
I love this conversation, unemployment. So if you are not working, you've not finished, and you're in a low paid job and a psychologist appointment is $250 or an assessment's $3,000, you won't have the money. And yeah, I absolutely agree with you. The adverse effects of having undiagnosed neurodiversity or ADHD are crazy. And I think then if you're in a population that doesn't have a lot of money or a not great career, healthcare is expensive, private healthcare is expensive. Mm-hmm. And are you going to go to the doctor? Do you have $100 out of pocket for a GP these days? The other thing I wanted to mention, because you just had so many nuggets of gold in there, was what I found when I was undiagnosed. So it was like, 36 years, I had already told myself lots of different stories about myself. So when I was diagnosed, it actually really scrambled my brain because I was like, but I thought that this was who I am. Oh, is this kind of not my fault, neurological? And I was wondering, what stories did you tell yourself about yourself before you knew you were diagnosed?
It's a really great question, Jane. So many. I have a very bad self-esteem. I talk to myself horrendously compared to other people. I would never talk to someone like that. The stories, I have issues with my weight, and I have since the end of high school. I have a bit of a binge eating problem that happens when I'm overly stressed or I have a lot of emotions going on. My coping strategy is eating, and I've done that for as long as I can know. And I didn't realize that is a massive part of my ADHD, and that's what I do to self-soothe and cope. That's my addiction, is like in a food kind of way. And I think I call myself horrendous names. The amount of times I've called myself fat, ugly, big, why can't you just do this? Just get up and do it, Millie. Like just really nasty things about my weight and about my body. And I really upsettingly, I've actually said this stuff in front of my daughter. I've been saying this probably out loud in front of my daughter since she was little. And I know the effects it probably is having on her and her body image. It's really hard for me to stop it. And I think that there, the story that is one of the biggest ones that I have is about, yeah, my ability to actually look a certain way, be a certain way, and just do the thing that I need to do to be healthy. I feel like it's so hard. And I just keep telling myself this story that I'm this horrible, bad person. Another story is my ability to be organized. I can do it when I have to do it for other people and for school, but for home, I'm horrible. And the amount of times I've told myself I'm a horrendous mother, and I have major meltdowns probably generally at holiday times. So my son is level 3 autistic, being diagnosed since he was 2.5. He is non-speaking, and I hate ringing people and calling the NDIS and calling appointments and having the appointments so much that I will avoid things. And then he doesn't end up getting the care that he needs because I am not great at organizing that myself. And I went through a period for 6 years where I was a single mum with my 2 kids. And the amount of times I would say, what kind of person does this? What kind of person doesn't call the NDIS lady back because she's scared to answer the phone or respond to something? And I know that, like, now knowing, because it's only been the last year and a half since I started to be like, this is not because I'm a shitty mum. I'm not a bad mum. I'm struggling with this stuff myself. The things that I'm trying to get support for him and my daughter, I struggle with myself, and no one's there at the NDIS supporting me properly to do these things. That's another story. I know you've talked about NDIS before, Jane, and that whole system is another thing. But that stuff is so hard. So then I'll end up not ringing someone back, and then I lose his spot at an OT appointment because I haven't responded. And then we're back on a waiting list for 8 months, and it's my fault. It definitely is my fault, but I am starting to be more kind around it. I'm starting to ask for help as well. So I probably used to just be like, I'm just shit. Get better, Millie. Why can't you just do the thing that you need to do to help him out? But now I need help for these things. So to be able to do some of these things, I'm like, someone needs to help me fill out the form and help call the places, because I'm not going to do that very well. I'm not going to follow up with whatever they've emailed. So I have some different people that are supporting me with those things, because I've been able to acknowledge that I'm not good at those things, and that's okay, but I need some support. So I think, yeah, there's some of the, there's definitely more for everyone, but they're probably the really biggest stories. And I think a lot of us mums do that, especially ADHD mums. We struggle with executive functioning. More executive functioning is it than having kids. Like, everything requires executive functioning, getting them dressed, filling out enrollment forms, paying for their things, and giving permission. The amount of times I don't give permission for the thing is so often. It'd be like they call me up and they're like, oh, the thing's today and you haven't. And I'm like, I'm so sorry. And I'm a teacher. I work at a school helping parents, like asking parents to give permission to these things. But personally, I can't do it myself. So yeah, really interesting. That's a good question, Jane, because yeah, I think we all have these stories. And I think if I had have known sooner, because I'm starting now, I'm starting to be more compassionate, ask for support. And I think my self-esteem, I think your first question about why is it so important to get a diagnosis? And I think the diagnosis, it changes your perspective, your compassion, and your self-esteem and identity. My identity has been built up with, yeah, I can do all these really great, fantastic things, but I'm also really shit at the root of everything, and I'm not really shit. So I think that's, yeah, my identity that I've created is all around the fact that I can't do stuff, but I can do these things really well. My identity should have been around compassion, that yes, I don't do these things as well as other people. However, this is what I can do to help myself and support myself. And that would have been, it's life-changing. I don't know for you, Jane, but like the diagnosis for me is life-changing. Since I found out last year, my life has completely change trajectory. Like, we're doing this podcast now because you got a diagnosis as well. So it's life-changing and more accepting, and there's a lot of work involved the later you get the diagnosis. It's so much work to unpack all that stuff and change those habits that you've been doing for so many years. That self-talk is terrible. I know it's terrible, but I still keep going back to the habit. If you can catch that when you've got a seven-year-old girl at school, imagine, I can just only imagine myself knowing since I was then those things, what it would have done for my self-esteem and my identity moving forward.
I love that you said that, because one of the things that I really learned from you in our last interview was we were talking about camouflaging and masking, and it was an incredible interview. We were talking about how important it was to get diagnosed, and I was absolutely saying that. And then you took it a step further and you said, yeah, but not only that, you actually have to disclose that diagnosis to your child. And that end of last year was something I hadn't done. Then you said, I wish I had been talking to my daughter about it earlier. I wish I had spoken to her about it in early primary school. When you said that, completely scrambled my brain, because I was thinking, oh, well, she's a bit young. My daughter's seven. Oh, I'm going to wait until she's 11. You know how you delay things? ADHD, right? Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm not going to do that now. I'm just going to be doing that later on. And then you delay it. And when you said that, it really struck me. And then you said, what if another teacher tells her or someone talks to her about it and they don't know that she knows? I was like, oh my God, that would be my worst nightmare. If it is, her story of her diagnosis ends in me not telling her and her overhearing it from someone. So that then pushed me to actually have the conversation with her and talk to her about it on the daily, as opposed to having it be something that maybe you talk about once, you never speak about again. And then you've got a bit of a festering wound in that if someone passes away and then no one talks about them again, it's like weird. And then it becomes taboo and then no one says anything and it becomes this thing. I really appreciated that conversation. What benefits do you think it gives the child to actually disclose it?
I think it, especially in a school environment and at school, they know they're different. They're not sure about it. Most students that are diagnosed with something or have something going on, they know they're different anyway. They know, and it's not going to change whether you get a diagnosis or not. It actually isn't going to change who they are and what they naturally are like and how they are in the classroom or with friends, socially, at home. All of these things aren't going to necessarily change with a diagnosis. However, they know anyway. They know that they're different. And I think what happens is they internalize that. They internalize that, again, the same things, that self-talk that I have now happens. It starts when they're younger. They watch other people and go, okay, that's what normal people do when they socialize. That's what I need to do. And that's when the masking happens too. If you're not talking about this with your child and teachers aren't talking about this with the classroom and the environment, you don't know what you don't know. And you just go, oh, I can tell I'm different. I don't know what it is. I'm different. I'm just weird. I'm a bad student. I'm really, like, I'm not smart. I'm dumb. All of these things happen because they don't know. I think it's the same thing that I was saying about myself. It's that compassion. It's being able to teach them, this is how you can manage this a little bit. Like, there are some things like that we can do together to help manage this. And I'm not talking about changing things about people. I think that sometimes is, if that's the motivator for diagnosis, to change or alter them or make someone more normal, that's just making someone mask, and that's not the purpose of it. The purpose is for their mental health and well-being. The purpose is for them to understand their unique brain. The purpose is for them to learn how to be themselves in the world and form that really great identity. And you can't do that when you don't know that you're different and there's a reason why you're different. They know it, but they don't know the reason why. So it's so important. I think you can see if everyone in the classroom, if it's a safe environment where everyone, different brains are championed and celebrated, and everyone, I know that this person does this over there, they have to listen to a prompter on the computer. And that's because that person, they don't listen to the instructions the first time, or this person needs a visual. If everyone accepts everyone's different things, and it's like they can do what they need to do and get the support they need to get without feeling like they're weird, different. The weird word's a massive big one, and it happens in school a lot. And I think students need to know themselves, but we need to talk about it with other students too, because that peer kind of stuff that happens and bullying, and the word weird is very hurtful and very upsetting for students. And I think if you can reframe it, I've got a different brain. If everyone just goes, we all have different brains and that person does this thing and that person does that thing, the more you talk about it, the more you normalize it. It has a stigma still at the moment. Any neurodivergent diagnosis has a stigma at the moment. Just look at the word ADHD, the name of the diagnosis in itself is, it's attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Firstly, disorder sounds terrible. Hyperactivity. So if you're a girl who in their mind is like racing thoughts, and that's hyperactivity in their mind looks very different to what it looks like with a little boy jumping off the walls, never being able to sit down. It looks different. So we need to talk about the fact that my brain works like this. In my head, I'm thinking 1,000 different thoughts while you're talking to me and giving me instructions. And that means that I need this kind of learning. They can empower themselves to self-advocate. Do you know what I mean? Knowing, I've come across a couple of students that I know that have had a diagnosis and that feel of it, they share that with people. They go, oh, I've got dyslexia. And that means that I have trouble with this kind of reading, but then I'm using this because of that. And they explain it to the other kids, and all the other kids, especially at primary school age, sure, cool. They have no concern or difference about it. But as you get older and you get to that high school age, if you don't know, this is, I did mention that to you last time, Jane, about my daughter, and I'll bring my daughter back into it now because I even asked her, I think I asked her a couple of months ago, how do you feel about the fact that I didn't tell you properly when you were in primary school? And would you have liked to have known earlier? And she was like, yes, because I actually thought she knew there was something and she knew we needed a diagnosis of some sort, but I didn't fully explain it. And she was like, I just thought it was like the reason why I get angry all the time was we went and did this thing and that's, I get angry all the time because, and I thought that was me just being angry all the time. That's all she really knew. I didn't go into detail and I really regret, and I did explain that to you last time, I really regret not saying anything to her because her identity now, she's already got so much of that stuff that's happened in primary school and the start of secondary school. And I'm trying now to have these conversations and we're trying to help her understand her brain and how it works. But I feel like she's already built some of those stories and I'm already having to get back and take away some of that trauma. I even apologize for the way that I dealt with her when she was in primary school because she was so hard for me. It felt like she was so hard for me because I didn't know how to manage myself and my emotions and my reactions to her. So when she came home from school, overwhelmed from masking all day, and she would lose it. Chairs would be thrown. I've had holes in walls, like extreme meltdowns that didn't happen at school. No one saw these things. I was not equipped to manage my own emotions in those times. So now that I know, we both can talk about it. After we have a bit of, sometimes we both escalate it and we just go on at each other. About an hour later, we can both calm down and come back and be like, that was both of our emotional reactions. We both jumped to a conclusion here. We can go back and talk it through and explain, I did this because I wasn't angry at you. It was actually stress from work. I did the same thing that you did. So I've come home from my masking day and I've unloaded on you as well. So we're able to have these really good dialogue about the reason why we're doing something. Doesn't mean we stop doing it. We're not stopping doing some of these things, but we're able to be kind to each other. And sometimes I'll be like, I understand. I get why you're doing that. And you can understand why I'm doing this. It's that understanding. And I think it's so important to share, and the benefits of knowing, the earlier the better, and the education that comes from that for the other students is really exciting too. The more people that know that there are students in the class that need different things and we all get different things that we need, what an amazing thing to teach them younger. So when they get up into high school and university and jobs, they believe that also, that this person needs that support because that's what their brain needs. It's just, it's a fabulous like thought process. And I don't think, obviously we're not there yet, a lot of the adult world and the workplace world. Yeah, I think it's so great if we can all start telling our students in primary school, this is what's going on for your brain, and being really inclusive and accepting. It's a game changer for them. And I think it will stop a lot of trauma moving forward.
I love what you've said. One thing that has struck me, when I was about 15, I wish I still had it. I wrote this beautiful poem about having a mask. This is before masking was a thing. Depression was just a brand new thing back then. So I remember I wrote a really beautiful poem about wearing a mask, and I ended up taking the diagnosis a step further. That's that conversation with Gigi. And because she said to me one day, I was dropping her off at maybe an after-school program or somewhere, and she said to me, can I be myself here? And my immediate response was, of course you can be yourself here. Like, I think it was an art class. Of course you can be yourself here. This is a safe environment. Absolutely. She goes, but not really. I said, but yeah, of course you can. She goes, but not really, because when things happen that I don't like, I can't say anything. If there's paint on my hands and I want to wash it off straight away, I can't. If someone says something to me and I don't think it's funny, I have to laugh anyway. And that's actually not being myself. And I was like, whoa, she's got such a good brain on her.
That's amazing thinking.
I was
it?
like,
that's so
holy
good.
Shit. Yeah. And so I ended up going, oh, actually, I think you're right. You are right. You can be yourself, but not fully. Anyway, I dropped her off, thought about it for most of the day. And then when I picked her up, we had a conversation on the way home about it. And I said to her, you're actually right. There's probably only three people in this world that I don't actually wear a mask with that are adults. And she's like, I have to wear my mask all the time. And we named it, spoke about it, and acknowledged it comes on and off. But I said to her, I don't want you to wear a mask at home because you want to make me happy or get along, or I'm having a bad day and then you're trying to please me. You can't wear your mask at home. It's too draining if you wear it all the time. We ended up having this really open discussion about masking. And now she gets in the car, puts it on, physically puts it off with her hand. And I thought that was so powerful, because if you haven't had that conversation, because I don't want her to feel like she's the only person doing that, because that's how I felt when I was a kid. I was like, there's something wrong with me. Because you know what you were saying earlier? You were saying about how you're putting this thing out to the world. I'm Millie Carr. I'm a teacher. I've got no doubt you're very good at your job, right? But then you've got this mismatch with your own kids, or not getting the permission form back, or whatever it is that's going on. And I would always, as a child and before getting diagnosed, feel like a real fraud, like a fake, because I'd be putting out this organized Jane, but actually it'd be completely chaotic everywhere else. Did you ever feel like that?
Oh, yeah. The unauthentic of it really upsets me and affects me, because I want to be vulnerable, but I still struggle now. Like, I still mask at work. I can't be myself at work properly, because I know that what I've put out in the past is what people expect me to be. That is who I am, the Millie that does all these things and knows all these things, but then doesn't always do it at home. And even when I come out and tell people about my struggles, it's a lot of the time no one's seen it. It's me telling people about it. Have many people, and I did grow up probably masking more at home in my environment, and I didn't really have many places to go, and food became like my thing. I used to come home from work and just stay in my room and like binge eat on stuff. But I only am really truly comfortable in front of my kids and my partner. Like, my friends sometimes see little snippets of it, but even then, like, we went away last week. I went away with a group of mums for a weekend, seven of us mums, and I can talk about all this stuff, but I don't fully let myself be myself the way I am when I'm by myself here at home, or when I'm with my kids and my partner. I'm not truly myself, because I still am worried about what people are going to think, and I don't feel comfortable that people are going to think bad things about me. And that conversation, Jane, is so important, I think, to have, that you've had with your daughter about that masking, where it is safe and isn't safe to mask, because the world isn't really set up for us to be our authentic self all the time.
It's just not.
It's really not. And it's so sad. It's really sad, and it really upsets me, because I would love to be myself. I'd love your daughter to be herself at her art class. Like, what better place to be yourself? But we don't feel like we can be ourselves, because that's a bigger society kind of pressure. And I think girls sometimes face it more than boys, because you expect boys to be silly or loud. It's not right or wrong, but you do expect that more because of our society pressures. Girls, we're meant to be good mums. We're meant to do the paperwork. We're meant to, parent a certain way, be a certain way in class. I definitely felt that. And I still feel that. And I still keep doing that. And I want to be authentic, though, because it starts to hurt at your inner self and your inner kind of core values. Because if you're not being your authentic self, no one sees you. No one sees the real you. And you can't really feel like you belong in places, because I am well liked at work. People know that I do what I do. I'm a very friendly, bubbly, happy person all the time. But I don't always feel comfortable. I often sit in the staff room and I'm always still thinking about what I'm doing, how I'm sitting, how I'm presenting, what I say. It still is so much going on in my head to make sure that I am presenting myself in a particular way that comes across even though I will openly say, yes, I have ADHD. Yes, I'm on medication. Yes, I do all these things. They don't see it. They hear me tell them that I'm doing these things. People struggle to believe that about me because they know me as what they see and what I present to people. And man, would it be nice for the world to be accepting and safe for people to be themselves. I would have loved to have known early and actually, yeah, because I'm trying. I really want to be myself because it's pretty fun. It's pretty cool. I'm very funny and very like interesting and emotional and deep and all these things, but I don't always put that out there because I know I'm in a leadership position. So I've got to try and hold it. Like, but why am I doing that? Why aren't I being vulnerable with the people that are working with me and knowing, oh, yeah, I'm starting to shift and move into this kind of like vulnerable, authentic space, but it's hard. And I think without people knowing about themselves and how they learn and how they are, you can't have that discussion. But having that discussion, Jane, with your daughter, absolutely fantastic. And it's an ongoing discussion, isn't it? You can't just be
absolutely.
You have ADHD.
Absolutely.
It means.
Exactly. And it can be so relevant because there was a school camp for the first time. And I think grade three personally is probably a little young for a school camp. Okay. That's what they're doing. So there was a school camp and she was really stressing about it. And I did say initially, you'll be fine. Everyone's going. I know it's nerve wracking, but when you get there, you'll be right. But then I tried to shut my mouth and listen as opposed to talk. And when she actually unpacked it, she said to me, I can't wear a mask for 3 days. That was the problem. Mm. It wasn't that she was scared of going and she needed a teddy bear at night or whatever it was that I thought. It was that she knew that she was going to have to wear a mask for 3 days straight and she was going to be exhausted and she would have no place to take that off and have a rest. And I just thought, wow, look at that awareness. If there was ever a time that I couldn't have been prouder of myself for talking about it openly, which I have to thank you for, Millie, because I was prepared to just keep it down low until she was 12. I don't know why I had 12 in my mind. So actually talking about it allowed it to be okay for her to say what she was really feeling and actually figure it out. Because as soon as I realized that, I was like, you know what? We might not go on that camp. I don't know. Let's just shelve it. It's not to the end of the year. And then because I thought to myself, that's a pretty good reason, isn't it? That's a good reason because I went to a conference and I couldn't mask for 3 days. And I thought, fuck, if I had to work all day, go to sleep with these people in a cabin and then get up and then do it all for 3 days, that would kill me. I get what she's saying.
And then what happens if you've got her coming home to you in a state? Do you mean like holding on to that for 3 days is such a toll that it has on your body. And when you're doing this constantly, that's what leads to the burnout.
Exactly.
Where the burnout comes into it, because if we don't teach them to honor their energy and honor what they need to do, it's so fabulous, Jane, that you're doing that, because you're teaching her that I can't do that. And it's okay for her to say no. My mom would have been like, just go. You have to just go, suck it up.
Totally. And this is what I said, building resilience. This is about building resilience. I'm air quoting. It's not about building resilience. And this is about knowing then, okay, maybe they can't do it. And maybe it isn't resilience building to push her into that and then expect her to jump into the car at the end and tell me what a great time she's had. Maybe that's not realistic for her, but I would much prefer to know than to push her onto that bus and just assume she's going to be fine and have her have a breakdown when I then take her to school the next day or to an after a school activity and then wonder why it's all too much. Because that's completely unfair. She's eight.
She may be ready for it later though, Jane. So you allowing her to advocate for herself and know her capacity and be compassionate about that, when she gets to a year seven camp, she might be like, okay, maybe I don't need to mask because I feel more comfortable now to actually not mask as much. Maybe I have a friend that I can really be myself with overnight. So that's going to help me because I can let go of it a little bit at night time or something. So she'll be able to advocate and understand that. And I think it's about not pushing, because everyone's capacity changes. You might have her capacity at one particular time is this, but then a capacity at a different time, it's the same thing. So seemingly this is what happens a lot of the time. People are like, this student could do that, but now they can't do it on like the next week. But it's about your capacity and honoring that capacity, because yeah, she may be able to do that in that moment because she's been able to do all these other things to support herself before that. She's had all this unmasking time, or it's been really downtime before she's went to camp, or if she's got a little friend, whatever it is. Or it could be like, no, I just can't right now. And that's okay to have that kind of response. And I think Yeah, schooling systems are really hard with this because you've got some teachers that are on board with these things and some that are not. And I think I mentioned it was last year on my stories last year. I had a giant, the very end of the year, I had a really big thing with my daughter being placed in classrooms. She only has one friend at school, literally one little girl that she actually hangs around with, and everyone else, it's very awkward and really stressful for her. And they did not put her in that girl's class once for any subject. And they
Oh
were
my
doing multiple
God.
subjects together. Nothing at all. And I am not the kind of person normally, because I'm a teacher myself, I understand the logistics of planning and timetabling and all this kind of stuff. But I think they looked at me stupid when I called and also went inside to talk to them about it. I felt like they thought I was just ridiculous. They ended up like changing it because I think they thought it was just easier. But I could tell they fully really didn't understand what I was trying to say. They are aware that she's autistic. I've explained that before. I've talked, and she doesn't get many accommodations. She doesn't require it at school as much. Socially is like the biggest thing for her. And they were like, oh, maybe we'll have a look. But they didn't really actually understand or take what I was saying really into. She's only got one friend in the entire school. She needs a few classes with her to help her with social things and to help her feel herself and not feel like she's alone the entire time. And I think that's what some teachers do, like, they've got to go to camp or they've got to go and do this thing because the rest of the class are doing it or whatever it is. And I think, yeah, that's part of that education and advocating for themselves and being an advocate as a parent as well. Because you'll have teachers that are really on board and go, yes, completely understand what you're saying. We need to like really support and do these things. And you'll have others that don't understand and don't have a great awareness of what this means for our students. And they just will refuse or say what you're saying, resilience. We're building resilience. Yeah, I'm going to go on like a side quest, Jane. So, but why do we have to force children? The play thing really upsets me. Often we'll have autistic children or neurodivergent children that have trouble making friends, but they are okay only playing with one friend. But in their goals and their things, the goal for them is to talk to a different person and build a bigger social group or to talk about something that they don't feel comfortable talking about. That's a goal that's written in these kids' IEPs, is to build this. But why do we have to do it? Like, a lot of autistic children don't like playing with lots of people. They don't like being around a giant group of people. They only want one or two probably close friends that they can be themselves with. So why do we have to push them to do things? And I think that's that next step, this diagnosis, being aware of it ourselves so we can advocate at school with friends, with parents, and all of this kind of stuff, because people don't know what they don't know. And I don't get angry or upset at some people that just don't know these things. They think they're doing the right thing. But us talking about it now, students knowing, your daughter knowing, she's going to be able to, if a teacher asks her something, she's going to be able to be like, no, I can't do this right now because I can't mask for this thing here, or this is what's upset me because of whatever happened here. She'll be able to tell people what she wants and what she needs because you've been having conversations with her about how to support her, how to help her thrive. She'll be able to advocate for that. She's going to get into the workplace in her 20s and she'll be able to say, you know what? I'm not going to just do this because the workplace is telling me that everyone has to do this, because why do we have to do it this way? So she'll be able to advocate for that. And that's going to be hopefully the change that happens in the next couple of generations, because that awareness and that discussion's happening, because diagnosis is actually being told to to our students. They know what it means. And it's not a bad thing. I guess it's so upsetting that some people are so scared of it because they think it's bad. It's a negative thing. It's, oh, you're telling me my child is something wrong with my student. And it's nothing about being wrong. It's all about helping them understand and unlocking their potential. Because if you don't know about yourself, you can't know how to support yourself and everyone else in the situation can't either. So, yeah, it's that next step, I think. And you're doing some great work, Jan. I love that you've had those conversations with her. It's great.
Oh, look, it's only a lot of people send me DMs saying thank you for the podcast, but the community gives a lot back too, and the interviews give me a lot back too. So it's not a one-way street at all. One thing I wanted to talk about briefly was you were saying about how maybe sometimes people think that a diagnosis is a bad thing and that we're going to label our kids as having something wrong with them. And I'm air quoting of that, of course. However, children are like a blank canvas, really. They actually don't know what any of this means. So when I spoke to Gigi, it was interesting because she had no preconceived ideas. She didn't know what I was talking about. It was so refreshing to talk to somebody with no preconceived concepts. I was just wondering if there's anyone listening and they're like, okay, maybe I should talk to my daughter, particularly, or my son. What would be some ways or some good things to think about when you're having that conversation?
I think the first thing you said earlier, Jane, about making sure you're the one that kind of says it to them, your fear of it coming out or someone else saying it to them without you having that discussion. I think you being the person, not even the psychologist or the psychiatrist, whoever's done the diagnosis, I think you having that conversation with them, their safe person, is really important. I think it helps build that acceptance with them. And like you said, they're a blank canvas, so you can talk to them how you want to. I think it's really important to make sure that it's at a time where they're really calm, they're really regulated, and they're feeling like you can share and make it personal for them. So I think it's really good to be like, when you do this, when this kind of happens, like negative or positive thing, I think using both challenging things that we have and also the really strength things that we have come with our diagnosis, sharing those things and being like, when you do that, it's because of this thing. And this is why it happens like that. And the reason why you struggle with some of these things is because of this kind of thing. Together researching some of the strategies that work for them. Because there's lots of strategies out there and different things, but not everybody will have the same ones that work for them. And I think exploring together and researching and being curious together around, oh, okay, let's investigate what is something that maybe we can do to help us when we come home from school when we're feeling really anxious and we've had the mask on all day. Let's investigate some different things that we can do and trial some different things together. I always use a book. And I think when you've got an autistic student, we often use social stories. I'm not sure how much your audience base know about social stories, but they're a story that's usually used for autistic students to explain what's happening, what's going to happen. And I think using picture storybooks in the same way with any diagnosis and any student, they understand in a way that's different. They're looking at the story and go, oh, I can see myself in that. And even if you use it like you did, Jane, as a conversation starter, reading different, there's books around everything. You can find books on any topic that's aimed at students and children. Now there's ones about mental health as well as emotions, feelings. If you read these books to the students and have a discussion about that and go, oh, does that relate to you? Asking them questions, I think, is also really important of how you can help disclose a bit of a diagnosis. And like you said, that ongoing discussion. It's not just, okay, I'm going to sit them down for an hour, I'm going to tell them their diagnosis, and that's the end. It's ongoing small moments, finding those small moments. And I think when you've got a diagnosis yourself, even more important to share your feelings and your experiences, because I don't know, I can't explain how much more close my daughter and I are now that we both have some similar experiences to talk about, because she thought that she was different. She didn't have that belonging in that community. And how amazing to have. And look, we know that a lot of neurodivergent diagnoses are hereditary. There is generally someone in the family that has got something similar or can relate to that child as well. So having someone be a role model or talk about that with them is really important. Even highlighting role models that they know, actors and actresses, there are multiple people now coming out with diagnoses and talking about these things themselves. I think it's amazing because the role models, people look and go, wow, I did not know that person had ADHD, and that just, it changes, like they're successful, like they're really successful people. So all of those kind of little tips, I think, would be a really great way to start the conversation and continue it going by just constantly talking about their experiences and helping them reframe what's happening in their lives and build a really great bank. Building a bank of tools to help and to lean on is so important. Not to change. Again, I really want to highlight the point of, I don't want people to think that diagnosis means I want to change people. That's not what we want. We want people to build some tools, support them, and be their best self.
Yeah, and I think build acceptance is the ultimate key, awareness and acceptance. And then my hubby, I think, probably thinks we talk about ADHD too much, but probably because I'm paranoid that it's not spoken about enough. And so I want to make sure it's really open and everybody's aware and I openly accept who I am, because I think you can't have that conversation and go, you need to accept who you are. You're okay. Everything's fine. There's nothing wrong with you. And then you actually then inadvertently are sending that message because you aren't talking about it again or whatever it is that's going on. For example, I think in the small moments, I just was thinking an example. Let's say this morning my daughter was going to Minecraft camp, which obviously requires an iPad. So when we walk around in the morning, obviously I've got three kids, everybody's trying to go somewhere. I'm trying to go to work. My husband's, it's a whole dog's breakfast in the morning. And I have things that I have to remember. And so I said to my daughter this morning, Geej, we've got to remember to put your iPad in the bag. And she's like, yeah, I'll get it in a minute. And I was like, okay, Gigi, this is what I'm talking about, because I know you're going to get distracted and you're not going to put it in your bag. I get that. But just letting you know, it takes all of my brain power to remember that you need an iPad. It's so obvious that it's the thing that I will forget. And then when we arrive and we don't have the iPad, we're going to wonder how this has happened. If I have to then remind you over and again, what we will find is that we will end up with not the iPad. So I know it's really hard, but when I ask you to do something, I need you to just really focus, because if you're relying on me to re-remind you, you're running the gauntlet, because we have the same brain. And it's actually in an honest conversation like that, that she actually got it, because I think she just thought I was a robot who was an incredible person, probably. When you're eight, you still think your parents are great. And I think she thought I was just like going to remember and I was going to just pick up after her mistakes all the time. But I was saying to her, gee, this is the problem, and this is how we arrive without shoes and a hat and the essentials, because we have the same brain. And I know it's hard, but don't rely on me, because I'm no good to you. And then as soon as we had that conversation, she's actually been a lot better. And I've been a lot better as well around the communication. So I think those small moments are really important. And even if you think that they're a child, they won't understand, what I found is often they do.
Oh, you'd be surprised, seriously. They are so smart. And this is what I think we sometimes dumb down vocabulary, dumb down explanations to things, to students, because we think that children and students, they don't understand. But they understand, like they understand. And if you explain it to them, like you did, and then they get it and go, oh, yeah, actually, that makes a whole lot of sense. And how beautiful that you can have that really honest communication about the fact that it's the same. Yes, you're going to forget, but also I'm going to forget. Let's try and put this in place for us both so that I don't feel bad that you've forgotten the iPad as well. I think it's really great, because that's what you need to do. That's the change that's going to happen if we start talking about this with our students, really, students and children openly. The changes that they're learning, and they learn, and you've got some great tips that you've learned and you've been doing for however many years. Sometimes you don't realize the things that you've started building before we were diagnosed. So I'd be like, oh, so I spent, my daughter needs to do some schoolwork over the school holidays, and she needed to do it. And she's like, oh, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to procrastinate the entire school holidays. She's in year 10, and she's, I'm going to procrastinate the whole holidays and that I won't get it done. And I said to her, you know what? I've got schoolwork to do. Like, I've got some stuff to do. Let's do it on Wednesday, the first week. I said, because I will leave it also. And then the end of next week, we'll both be like scrambling, trying to do all our work together. And I said to her, why don't you do it on Wednesday? And I do it on Wednesday. Let's both get it done the first week on Wednesday. We had a bit of time to relax after school finished. So we're not like too early in doing it, but we've had a bit of a break. We're going to get it done, so we don't have to feel bad next week. And then next week, we'll both be a little bit more chill and the anxiety will be better. And she's like, yeah, okay, let's do it. She's not with me at the moment. She's with her dad. So I messaged her and I was like, are you doing your work? And she's like, yes. And I was like, okay, me too. So we were both just like holding each other a bit accountable to it, because I did the same thing that you were saying. I said to Charlotte, I will do the exact same thing. I will procrastinate that the whole holidays. I will think about it and go, oh, I should be doing it, should be doing it, should be doing it, when I could just get it done earlier, but I never get it done. Both of us do that, but we've made a pact, which got it done earlier yesterday. So we both help our anxiety a little bit. So little things like that, I think it's so important to talk about those things and talk about those strategies you use for yourself, because that kind of like, it'll help build them up. I think it's lovely.
Absolutely. And then one final question, Lily, is what role would a teacher play in diagnosis? So how can teachers approach parents if they think their student might be autistic or dyslexic or an ADHDer? Like, how does that play out?
Yeah, I think it's really important that teachers have a really big role in this, because sometimes the parents don't know anything. Do you mean? If they have no awareness of any diagnosis, or they're very similar, because we know that genetics plays a role, and they just think they're just like me and that's the same, it's really hard for them to pick that up and notice that and get that diagnosis, because they just don't know. And I think teachers have a really big role, because they see a lot of it in the classroom. They see a lot of different diagnoses. They are aware generally of someone having something that's not completely beneficial to them, or it's holding them back with their learning or socially. And I think making an appointment with the parents is really important. I think coming from a really positive neuroaffirming lens. So you don't want to come at it, because a lot of parents get really defensive about the fact that, oh, you're saying there's something wrong with my child. There's nothing wrong, because I do that too. That's actually happened to me before, where people have gone, I do that too, and there's nothing wrong with that, which is a bigger kind of issue, and potentially that they haven't had a diagnosis themselves. But I think coming at people, it's not about a diagnosis to say what's wrong with your child or to label them with something. It's a diagnosis to help them with their mental health, with their well-being, with the way that we cater to them in the classroom. And look, even if parents, some parents will just flat out refuse. And there may be other factors involved. We spoke about at the start, Jane, about there are different socioeconomic backgrounds and in different cultures that might have more barriers involved in getting a diagnosis, money-wise, lots of things. Getting a diagnosis isn't the be-all and end-all, and I want teachers to know that as well. If you have a student you suspect has got ADHD, is autistic, dyslexia, and the parent refuses, so you get them in for a meeting, you've tried really hard to say that it's going to be a really supportive thing for them to help them, the parent still isn't on board for whatever reason, that doesn't mean that you can't help them. And I know that we get funding for various different students and different things, but there are some really easy things that teachers can do to still support all of the students in the class. It doesn't hurt as well. So I think having the conversation is really important. Don't put it off though, because I've had students that I've worked with in grade five that there were some of these concerns going since like year two, but no one's ever actually spoken to the parents about it. They've never actually been like, and I think some teachers, especially new teachers in the profession, or teachers that aren't confident with some of these diagnoses themselves, they don't want to have that conversation because it's really hard. And they don't want to have the parent go, oh, you think my child's something wrong with my child. But get someone to support you to have that conversation with them. Because like I said about earlier, the earlier the diagnosis, the earlier they know, the earlier we have these conversations, just the better outcomes for them in the long run in adulthood, so many better outcomes. So I think it's really important to make sure that if you are a teacher or if you're a parent and you suspect something and the teacher doesn't really realize because your child masks really hard, that you keep advocating and going in there and having that dialogue back and forth about what you're seeing and what's happening with your student, because it's so important to have that diagnosis and share awareness with parents and with teachers as well. So open dialogue, making sure that you actually say something if you see something that you're thinking that could be something that is a barrier for them in the future. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. And the other day we were at soccer and my son was playing and everyone was carrying on about how he's like a Kelpie dog because he just runs after the ball and he's got so much energy. And I made a flyaway comment and said he has ADHD. I was hoping this would wear him out, but it probably won't. And I thought, oh, this will see what happens here. And you know what? It opened up a really great discussion with two of the other parents going, oh, I think my son has that. The teachers approached me. I haven't done anything about it. And I was like, well, there's a pediatrician that's really good. They're just 10 minutes down the road. They've just opened. And it actually really took away some of that heaviness that I think they were feeling because they were not wanting to say anything. They were really unfamiliar with it. And of course, one of them was a teacher, Millie. And she was like, I think I might have it. And I was like, that's okay. Me too. Like, it's all good. But sometimes I think an app breaks it down and helps other people who might be struggling with a similar thing, but aren't saying anything.
It's not a scary thing. I think it's a really massive diagnosis. The label is not a scary thing. And if we come at it in a really positive, strength-based approach, it's just going to have better outcomes for our students rather than negative things. Yeah, like you said at the start, there is no adult that I've spoken to that has regretted getting a diagnosis or knowing about their brain. And ultimately, the more we know about our brains, the more our students know about their brains. And there's more people than we know that actually have ADHD, that are autistic. And if everyone just starts saying, oh, I think that too, actually, it just normalizes it. And the conclusion is so much easier when you've got like everyone going, yeah, I know about that kind of brain. That's really cool. So yeah, the more we talk about it, again, I think we've ended every podcast we've had in this kind of way of being like, the more visibility, the more it's talked about, the more people are on podcasts like yourself, the more we're sharing things and talking to people about it, it just hopefully will take away the stigma and that really negative, scary kind of feeling of, ah, wrong. And ultimately, it isn't wrong. My brain, nothing's wrong with my brain. It's really amazing. It's just that in certain situations that society created, it can be taken as wrong. So celebrating strengths and learning about is just, education is like so important.
I think that is a great way of ending it. And I think it is a common theme that we seem to end on, Millie, but I think that's why you and I are aligned. If people say that was such an ADHD moment, yes, it can be annoying, but they're still talking about it. We're still opening it up. Yes, they're not using it that. autism follows in that people use the word more, even in the wrong way, just so people can learn, okay, that wasn't the right way to use it. How should I use it? Because if we're just all hiding and not saying any of the words, how will people even know how to say it or to disclose it? They never will. Thank you so much for your time, Millie. It's been a pleasure. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
The key message here is you are not alone. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, follow us on Instagram or head over and join our amazing ADHD Mums podcast Facebook community. Everything you do matters and helps to spread the word about what neurodiversity in females looks like.